You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 11th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, human rights attorney and assistant professor at Rutgers University in the Department of Africana Studies and the Program in Criminal Justice, Nora Ericott, is here, author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, on Sheikh Jarrah, the increasing understanding of Israel as an apartheid state. Meanwhile, 25 Palestinians, including 9 children, killed in Israeli airstrikes. In this country, the FDA authorizes the Pfizer vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds. In Washington, Joe Biden caves to Republican governors seeking to impose work search requirements to unemployment benefits. LA is taking steps to make its mass transit system widely free. Speaking of LA, in California, Governor Gavin Newsom, his new budget plan calls for the state to pay 100% of missing rent for low-income folks. Meanwhile, in the Senate, markup begins on S1, the voting rights bill. The FBI claims the hacking group DarkSide was responsible for the ransomware attack that shut down the Colonial Pipeline. You'll remember Colonial responsible for one of the largest spills from that pipeline in North Carolina just months ago. Meanwhile, since January, 1 million new people, or I should say new signees, have signed up for Obamacare. And lastly, Rahm Emanuel to be named ambassador to Japan. Apologies. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. Yes, sayonara to Rahm Emanuel. Gosh, I don't know if I know how to say hello to...
Konnichiwa.
Thank you.
Konnichiwa. To Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa. How are you today?
I am fine. Thank you. I am fine.
I noticed you grinning a little bit to start the show.
Yeah. Well, I got a message from a listener, and so I figured out what that mystery package was downstairs.
Oh, there we go.
We'll deal with that later. Really disturbing images coming out of Israel over the past couple of days. And of course, this has been part of an ongoing series of disturbing images for decades now. And at various points, there are flashpoints that rise above the fray. We have seen the Israeli government begin evictions of Palestinians living in East Jerusalem.
Living there for decades because of the peace treaty that Israel is now violating.
Well, I mean, they've been living there for decades upon decades. I'm just trying to come up with a reason why we have those evictions other than to say this is basically part of an ethnic cleansing project. In Jerusalem, and that has essentially started a new round of protests that were taking place on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Israeli government stormed the mosque. And then we saw rockets being launched from Hamas, the vast, I should say, from Gaza, by Hamas.
Yeah, I just want to like make that super clear, though, just because there were the evictions in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Netanyahu wasn't effectively able to get the Palestinians to retaliate in a sufficient way because he wants that that retaliation so he can build his coalition government. So then they storm the third holiest site for Palestinians in Jerusalem. They brutalize people. Hamas retaliates. And then what do you know? Israel retaliates hundreds more fold, kills children, kills dozens of Palestinians. And here we are. And, you know, the consensus in Washington is it's the Palestinians' fault.
Well, yes. And here is, we should say that in those air raids, there were rockets sent, like I was saying, by Hamas, 90% of which were stopped by the their Iron Dome defense system. I think there were six, maybe, Israelis who were injured. The retaliation led to the deaths of 25 Palestinians, nine of whom were children, 126 injured. And here is the State Department spokesman Ned Price asking questions from U.S. reporters, and you know, it's quite clear that the Biden administration does not seem to be prepared for this whatsoever. And to the extent that they are prepared, it is really they're prepared to do nothing. Here is Ned Price's response to reporters.
We're speaking of the principle of self-defense.
I'm asking if you think that the principle of self-defense applies to the retaliatory the airstrikes that they're conducting in response.
Matt, this is a very fluid situation. I would hesitate to comment on operations beyond, you know, the rocket fire that is clearly targeting innocent civilians in Israel. So I would hesitate to speak to specific operations that have just occurred. But the broader principle of self-defense is something we stand by on behalf of Israel.
Yeah, but
and
do you think
country.
That a Israeli military response to the rockets coming in, a military response to the rockets coming in is covered by this broader rubric of self-defense, right?
Self-defense often does authorize
secondly,
the use of force.
This,
thank you, Matt. I want to ask about East Jerusalem, but let's talk about what you said about the principle of self-defense. Does that in any way apply to the Palestinians? Do they have a right to self-defense? Do Palestinians have a right to self-defense?
In broadly speaking, Saeed, we believe in the concept of self-defense. We believe it applies to any state. I certainly wouldn't want my words to be construed as...
I understand. I want to ask you, and I don't want to harp on this either, but, you know, the Israelis killed 13 people just now, you know, including maybe five or six children. Do you condemn that? Do you condemn the killing of children?
Saeed...
I'm asking, do you condemn the killing of Palestinian children?
Obviously, and these reports are just emerging, and I understand, I was just speaking to the team, I understand we don't have independent confirmation of facts on the ground yet, so I'm very hesitant to get into reports that are just emerging. Obviously, the deaths of civilians, be they Israeli or Palestinians, are something we would take very seriously.
Okay.
You're going to know as soon as I read what your answer was that there's a big problem with it. You said, well... not a problem, it just doesn't answer the question. We believe that it, meaning the right to self-defense, applies to any state. Well, you see the problem, right? Yes?
Do you want to...
Do you regard Palestine as a state?
I wasn't referring...
But in the context of the ICC and the UN. You saying that you do not... If it applies to any state, are you saying the Palestinians don't have a right to self-defense?
I was making a broader point not attached to... Israel or the Palestinians in that case.
So they do have a right to self-defense.
Matt, I'm not in a position to debate the legalities from up here. What our message is one of de-escalation.
From one side, he doesn't mind commenting on the rocket attacks from the the ones after they were spurned into responding, because this is exactly what Netanyahu wants. He's fine with commenting just on the response from Palestine.
Well, I mean, this is the problem with the position of the U.S. government. It's untenable. And at one point, something's got to give. And we shall see. And this pressure may end up coming from ultimately from Congress. But I think it's going to take a while, frankly, before U.S. politicians catch up to where really the vast majority of Americans are, where we should not be funding to the tune of $3.8 billion the air attacks on civilians. I mean, we shouldn't be doing it. And it's quite clear that the way that the Israelis have been handling the situation, it's not going to change. They're just going to continue to dispossess Palestinians and continue to build settlements until we just in this ongoing fashion.
But I mean, we fund them, and that yet they hold us hostage. I mean, the brazenness of this, the way, you know, Ned Price, right, last name, the way he squirmed there. I mean, that shows the absolute weaknessness and cowardice of the Biden administration's foreign policy, the lack of imagination, and clearly the lack of gumption. It's gross to me. So,
okay, let's take a quick break, and we will be back with Nora Erekat. Folks, today's program is sponsored by Grove.co. I've talked about Grove quite a bit. It's where I get all of my natural cleaning products. It's hard to find, you know, or essentially it's hard to find natural cleaning products amassed in one place. Hard to find the best ones, and Grove.co makes it super easy. It is an online marketplace. It delivers healthy home, beauty, and personal care products directly to you. Grove Collaborative takes the guesswork out of going green. Browse the site for thousands of home, beauty, personal care products, all guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. You don't have to shop multiple stores or search endlessly online. You join over 2 million households who have trusted Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, shipping is fast and free on your first order. For me, I get all my 7th generation non-scented soap products, hand soap, dish soap there. I'm now big into their concentrated cleaners. They send you buy like a bottle, you buy it one time, and you create your own natural, like, spray, essentially. That stuff is great. Also, Mrs. Myers.
Love Mrs. Myers.
Use a bunch of the laundry stuff. Is that what it is? The laundry stuff? But
detergent.
I get all detergent, right.
Yeah.
I get my, you know, little dishwasher pellets from them, 7th generation there. And during COVID, I bought a bunch of like the refill stuff. So I have a lot.
You're stocked.
Stocked. Check it out, folks. It's a great, I use it as an app actually on my phone. But it's a great marketplace for natural products. Making the switch to natural products has literally never been easier. For a limited time, when our listeners go to grove.co/majority, you will get to choose a free gift with your first order of $30 or more. But you have to use our special code. Go to grove.co/majority to get your exclusive offer. That's grove.co/majority. Also, today's program is sponsored by Hunt a Killer. It's the murder mystery subscription box. That is the most exciting date night you can do at home. Hunt a Killer brings people together. It challenges them to decode ciphers. examine clues, solve puzzles. What happens? You get a delivery. You sift through the documents. They get evidence, audio recordings, case files, eliminating suspects, identifying murder weapons until you crack the case, and then you catch the killer. It's like an escape room that is delivered right to your door. And now you can grab some wine, obviously. You hop on Zoom. You play with your socially distanced friends. Maybe it's a good time to get together, too. Plus, there is a spoiler-free community with thousands of members to help each other solve difficult puzzles and talk about true crime. It has 100,000 active subscribers and over 2,000 five-star reviews. Also, part of the proceeds for every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation, an organization dedicated to helping with real-life cold cases. Mile and I did the... Well, the first one we did was like a high school reunion, I think it was. That was a while back. But the most recent one was the theater one. I can't remember what the name of it is, but it was about a theater in the 1930s, a cold case. And it was fun to be able to both, I mean, in the case of, you know, doing it with your teen kid, sort of just go back and make it historical. They're not all period pieces, this was. But fun and hard. You set up your bulletin board. You could do with the little strings, the red strings we got. We went full on. Thumbtacks.
Yeah.
Right now, you can go to hunttokiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure you use the code majority for a 20% discount. Do you have what it takes to hunt a killer? And a reminder, folks, this show relies on its members. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Welcome to the program, Nora Ericott. She is a human rights attorney and assistant professor at Rutgers University, co-founding editor of Jadalia, and the author of Justice for Some, Law in and the Question and in the Question of Palestine. Nora's having a little trouble with her camera. Oh, there you go. Nora, thanks for joining us. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. I appreciate your speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for being patient. It looks like there's a lot trying to block Palestinian voices from coming through, even the cameras.
Yes. Well, there you go. I want to start. I mean, if you could just, I mean, I want to broaden out, but from the incidences over the past couple of weeks, but if you could just start with the evictions that are taking place in Sheikh Jarrah, what are the supposed legal justifications for these evictions?
So let's start really close and basic about what's happening. Sheikh Jarrah is an East Jerusalem suburb, much like Silwan, Al-Izariya, Abu Dis, where I'm from. But the difference is that Abu Dis was cut off by the annexation wall that now cuts us off from the rest of Jerusalem. Those Palestinian communities who are within the boundary of the annexation wall, condemned by the International Court of Justice in 2004, are basically marked for removal, all of them. All of them are marked for removal by the state in order to be replaced with Jewish Zionist settlers. Sheikh Jarrah in particular was a city that was developed and built in the aftermath of Israel's establishment when Jordan was in control of the territory. It entered into an agreement with the United Nations Relief Works Agency, or UNRWA, in order to resettle the Palestinian refugees who were removed from their original homes within what became Israel, and instead came to be settled in this neighborhood in 1956. Since then, the agreement was that this is their new home. In about 1982, Jewish Zionist groups, let's be specific, wanted these homes and wanted to expand Jerusalem even further, and so filed a lawsuit against the Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah, who appointed an Israeli attorney to represent them, who then illegally represented them and entered them into an agreement with the Israeli state, whereby the land, as a result of this agreement, now belonged to the Jewish groups, but that they had some permission to remain in their homes but with no rights, with no title, with no, you know, no guarantee. They basically became visitors in their own home. They tried to vacate that decision, but it's remained on the books. And so what's happening right now in Sheikh Jarrah has been happening for decades. Most recently, some 10 years ago, a group of settlers started to move into the homes themselves with military backing. So you have the Hanun family and the Ghawi family that were displaced by settlers and lived in tents in the front of their streets. This family right now, Al-Kurd family, settlers took half their home. So imagine just being in your house and somebody coming into half your home and staying there. And now they want all of it. And when the families protested, when Munna al-Kurd protested and saying, you're literally stealing my home, one of the settlers responded and said, if it's not me, another settler is going to take it. So it might as well be me. So this is the current condition. And this is the pitched battle that's now reverberated across the territory where we see Palestinians in solidarity protesting across these violent fragmentations well beyond Jerusalem.
And it's been exacerbated I guess, coincidentally, because we now have celebrations by some in Israel over the annexation of East Jerusalem that took place now 50, 60 years, I guess.
So this is confusing, right? Because annexation actually took place... Israel, when it established itself, evicted some 80,000 Palestinians from West Jerusalem. We forget, we normalize that West Jerusalem is just Israeli, right? And forget that this is a home to Palestinians as well. In 1967, after the 1967 war, Israel then annexed East Jerusalem, expanded the municipal boundary by 10 times, annexed some 17,500 acres of West Bank land, and now marked the rest of it as part of Israeli territory and annexed it as an administrative matter, notwithstanding the condemnation of Israel's most significant allies in 67, the UK and the United States, right? In 1980, Israel reveals its removes its mask and says, no more administrative annexation. This is all Israel. And formally annexed it, East Jerusalem in 1980. Again, I think it was UN Security Council Resolution 480 issued in response. The next Security Council resolution to condemn it came in 2016 in Resolution 2334. But to say that this has been ongoing in terms of its annexation plans. Now, what might be signaled as different that has possibly encouraged what, you know, this wasn't inevitable, but it's not surprising, right? But what accelerated it was the Trump administration's moving of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in 2018. And, you know, one would imagine that the Biden administration, as part of its, you know, first acts of in power, would move the embassy back. But the DNC platform said that the embassy would remain in Jerusalem. The Biden administration said that the embassy would remain in Jerusalem. And now the Biden administration is fulfilling something that everybody thought was brazen when Trump did it, but has become normalized as basically what Israel has referred to as a real estate dispute, despite what it actually is, which is settler colonial eliminatory violence. The what's at stake is the removal of native Palestinians and to replace them with Jewish Zionist settlers. Those Palestinians will not just be homeless. This isn't about finding a new home. This isn't gentrification. They will be refugees.
Right.
They will be internally displaced peoples. That's a different framework that we should keep in mind.
And I just wanted to touch on, you know, why this was so punctuated now, right? Because to me, from the outside, it seems like yet another effort by Netanyahu to basically spurn Palestinian response, or at least, you know, it seems like that's what happened at the Alaska mosque, right? I mean, to basically provoke violence and then say, you know, what could I do, right? I had to respond and kill 9 Palestinian children and more adults. I mean, this seems to be right out of his playbook. Are these two instances connected? Because that's That's what it appears like on the outside, at least from my perspective.
I mean, I think that's great that you're seeing that Palestinians understand that full well. Part of what's happening, obviously, in the United States more than anywhere else, Palestinian death is read as an index for Israeli vulnerability, right? That speaks to the thorough dehumanization of Palestinian life, that if Palestinians are dying, Israel is in need of defense. So based on that very racist framework, it's always a go-to to then kill Palestinians within the rubric of some defensive force. Obviously, that's going to be more successful for Israel against Palestinians besieged in the Gaza Strip, which has been collapsed and made indistinct with Hamas, with, you know, Muslim terrorism, with fundamentalism. It's like this Islamophobic framework that just impedes all of our cognitive abilities to be able to understand what's happening. And their life becomes expendable. And that's what's been read. This is out of a bit of a playbook. We saw it in 2014, when after there was the kidnapping of three Israeli settlers in the West Bank, we saw in response, Israel respond incredibly forcefully against Palestinians in the West Bank, but then shifted to the Gaza Strip, which marked the beginning of what became a 51-day aerial campaign of a besieged population that could not become refugees of war. Israel killed some 2,000 Palestinians in the span of 51 days. I think it was 50,000 artillery shells, 6,000 airstrikes, 534 children were killed. You notice that no one's been held to account.
I want to have you give some background just so that people remember what the situation is in Gaza. But I also just want to note that this this playbook of essentially igniting a greater conflict, specifically with Al-Aqsa. I mean, this is exactly what Ariel Sharon did.
Yeah.
Exactly, but very similar to what Ariel Sharon did, I guess maybe about 20 years ago, that started the first intifada, if I remember correctly, and it was the second intifada, and it was in response, I think, to a concern that there was some possible potential for movement in terms of talks, I believe, at the time, and Sharon basically decided to take a walk through Al-Aqsa Mosque and started. I mean, this is a typical craven domestic policy maneuver, it seems like to me, in addition to obviously the horror that's involved for Palestinians. But speak to the situation in Gaza so that people are. Our memories can be refreshed as to essentially what remains more or less an open air prison on some level.
1,000%. I'm glad you raised the Ariel Sharon's provocation. It was September 21, 2000. I remember I was an exchange student from Berkeley. I wanted to study at a Palestinian university, but they said that was dangerous. So I had to study at Hebrew University, right? Which they did, no irony there, right? But I was there when this happened. And one of the first five Palestinians killed on that Friday, after that Friday prayer, was my neighbor in Abu Dis. I remember it very vividly, and then experienced the first few months of what has now become known as the Second Palestinian Intifada. At that time, the Camp David talks had fallen apart. It was clear that, it was the Clinton administration, together with Ehud Barak, they created this mythology of offering Yasser Arafat the most generous offer, which of course was a different version of, Bantustans with no right of return, no real sovereignty, no control of the economy, not maybe an airport, no standing army, no control of citizenship. And so when Yasser Arafat, seeing the writing on the wall and that Oslo itself was a trap, pulled out from the talks as they were collapsed, this is when Ariel Sharon walks onto the Al-Aqsa Mosque with 1,000 troops, right? And so, again, we see it every time Israel has even domestic, even political domestic issues where they're in disagreement, or Netanyahu is concerned about, his corruption charges. The man is indicted on corruption charges. you know, they go to a bombing campaign of Gaza because that unites Israelis in a way that is distracting. But at the root of it is the fact that that's how dehumanized Palestinians are, that Palestinian children die, right, to absolutely no response. My Twitter feed is filled with vitriol saying that they want Gaza turned into a parking lot, right? Imagine if I said that about Israelis.
Right. Of course, they would
imagine what would happen to me.
Yes, you would be excommunicated. And we should say, and before we get the emails, because I know every time this comes up, I just want to remind people that the supposed 98% of the West Bank that Arafat was offered at that time is the functional equivalent of me saying you could have 98% of my house. I just keep the kitchen and the bathrooms. Well, enjoy living there because you have none of the infrastructure that is going to make that house functional in many respects. So,
and in fairness, it wasn't 98%, right? I mean, those numbers are actually not accurate, but your analogy is right. It would be given permission to stay in the house without any of the rights. You don't own the land, you don't own the roof, you don't own the infrastructure. It's permission to stay, just like the residents of Sheikh Jarrah have been given permission, but they're not looking for permission. These are their lands. This is a native population, right? This isn't a transient population. They belong on those lands. And so they're not looking to be replaced or to live elsewhere. They're looking to remain.
Remind people the situation in Gaza. You know, when they start to send jets overhead in Gaza and bomb, and the inevitability of killing civilians and children. I mean, it's a foregone conclusion before the planes lift off.
That's correct.
They're going to do that. Just remind people what the situation in Gaza is like at this point.
So the Gaza Strip is about 365 square kilometers. It borders the Mediterranean Sea. It used to be a beautiful seaport and has been coveted by empires from the Roman Empire to the Ottoman Empire, who have fought over it as a primary seaport and also of strategic military interest. It also borders Egypt. It has 5 points of ingress and egress. 4 of the 5 are controlled by Israel. 1 of them is controlled by Egypt. It has been a greater site of resistance relative to the West Bank because it was under Egypt's rule from 1967 until 1993. And the Egyptian government, unlike the Jordanian monarchy, actually allowed for more Palestinian political activity. So Israel has regarded Gaza as a menace. And in 1993, slowly started to isolate the Gaza Strip from territorially and from the question of Palestine, and had a vision of making it into its own statelet rather than being part of the Palestinian state. So the first time we see a perimeter, an electric, you know, militarized perimeter around Gaza is in 1993. And since then, we've seen a policy of what Professor Sarah Roy has described as de-development. It's de-development and creating of dependence of the population so that they can't live on their own. These things come to a head in 2004, when Ariel Sharon, once again, offers to withdraw from the Gaza Strip unilaterally, remove some 12,000 settlers, which he then settles in the West Bank, and says, now the occupation is over. But what they did is they removed the settlers and the settler infrastructure, but maintained effective control of the territory, and then literally declared war the next year. When Hamas comes into power in 2006, Israel with the United States then impose a naval siege and a land blockade on Gaza, which means that for 15 years now, the Palestinian population in Gaza has been under siege. They have been kept on a caloric diet. They have not been able to maintain hospitals because their electricity generators don't run. They are constantly in short of electric supplies. They live around the clock and have built schedules with when they're going to have electricity and lighting.
Okay. Yeah. Can you expand upon those conditions? Because I don't think a lot of the people who, you know, even follow this casually understand. I mean, a majority of Palestinians don't have access to clean water. I mean, it is it is incredibly dire from a health perspective. So do you mind just giving some more examples about the occupied territories?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll give you one example just in terms of, you know, cancer patients who need to get treatment. So there's, they can't necessarily get treatment within the Gaza Strip because they need medicines that need to stay refrigerated. One, if they get access to those medicines because of the siege, they can't access them. Two, once they access them, they don't necessarily have the electric generators. Israel targeted the electric generators in the 2014 onslaught. I mean, this is what I would describe as necropolitics, but perhaps that's too much. This is not an academic audience, so I'll just leave it there. But targeted the electric generators so that they can't maintain those medicines. Now, those children who might want to get cancer treatment have to apply for moving permits to travel to hospitals within Israel to be treated. Israel doesn't allow them to travel with their parents. So Palestinian children who are cancer patients cannot get their chemotherapy and their treatment in one of the most traumatic moments and scary moments of their life with their own parents because of the complete control over their lives, right? This, I'm giving you a tiny example just to, I think the one thing, if anything I communicate to your audience is that there is a power disparity at play. And that power disparity cannot be whittled down to a conflict between two people who just can't understand. That's not the case. Israel is the 11th most significant military force in the world, the only nuclear power in the Middle East. It is an OECD member because of its robust economy, and it can actually control the movement of the Palestinian president. It can deny the Palestinian president from moving. There is no equivalence here. And the Gaza Strip is literally kept on the brink of non-life. It's bare living and constantly subjected. Now, if Israel start, Israel gave already named its operation against the Gaza Strip, which is very scary. It named it Operation Guardian of Walls. When Israel names its military onslaughts, it signals an impending gruesome offensive. I want to say it's probably going to be a massacre. I hope not. I hate saying that. But just to signal to folks, Palestinians are besieged. They are living on bare subsistence. Even if they wanted, they cannot become refugees of war if Israel becomes its onslaught. Israel will expand the buffer zone, and in order to protect its Israeli soldiers' lives, will then maintain primarily an aerial missile offensive where it can rain down missiles saying that it's targeting Hamas military weapons caches, but in fact, it's targeting Palestinian communities who have nowhere to hide. And then they tell us who are watching this, oh, but Hamas uses Palestinian human shields. And now you're stuck in the twilight zone of looking around and asking, wow, has it really come to this where even our humanity and our death become, even in that moment, we can't be victims and mourn ourselves. I was just in another interview and somebody wanted to ask me about Hamas rockets. And I really regretted not asking in response, who defends Palestinians? Right? Palestinians have asked multiple times for international peacekeeping operations. We need somebody. You don't want us to defend ourselves, fine. But we need something to defend us. And if you answer that question, maybe we can get somewhere. But the first response can't be to just condemn Palestinian responses.
That raises a good question. It's a little bit ahead of where I wanted to go, but let's just jump to the U.S. role in this. We just played a clip from Ned Price, who is the State Department spokesperson, who had been questioned yesterday about do Palestinians have a right to defend themselves? Price said, we believe that every state has the right to defend itself. And it was unclear whether he was forgetting that the Palestinians don't have a right to have a state, or if he was avoiding answering the question as to whether the Palestinians have a right to defend themselves. Give me your assessment of Joe Biden and the administration's policy at this point, but also relative to the U.S. foreign policy regarding Israel and the Palestinians. Really, I don't know. I mean, I guess over the past 20, 25 years, it seems to me there has been a real maybe this even from the Reagan era, we have seen the United States play less and less of a role of, or even attempting to play a role of an honest broker, right? Like, I don't know at various points if it's fair to say that they ever were an honest broker, but to the extent that they are, they were, they're much less so now. And I think during the Bush administration, essentially it was, we're not playing that game anymore. We're not an honest broker. And so that role has been eliminated. And I think to a large extent, what we saw during the Bush administration too was they no longer functioned as a ballast to keep the Israelis from their worst excesses. And once the Bush administration said, you guys go to town, go ahead, then the Israeli government, to the extent that there was anybody in the Israeli government that wanted to put the brakes on, had no excuse for their most, vicious of impulses. But give me your sense of that.
I think that's all incredibly on point. I do want to emphasize that the U.S. has never been an honest broker. Probably the last time that the United States was an honest broker vis-a-vis Palestinians was in the aftermath of the First World War, when they were seen as a counterweight to the British and the French, who wanted to maintain their colonial domination under the framework of the League of Nations mandate. That was probably the last time, and it was the Woodrow Wilson administration. But we've seen the U.S. steadily move, especially in the aftermath of the 1967 war, into the Middle East to fill the vacuum and to compete really with the Soviet Union in what was a Cold War at the time. That's when we see the U.S. initiate a policy of providing Israel with a qualitative military edge. That's where the unequivocal military support comes from, so that they can defeat singularly or collectively all the states of the Middle East should there be an attack, which is why Israel is the only nuclear power in the Middle East, which is why they maintain that it's a secret, an open secret, and are never pressured to sign the non-proliferation treaty in the way that, for example, we're seeing happen with Iran right now, right? So that's what the Lyndon B. Johnson administration initiates, this policy of qualitative military edge, as well as initiating a policy of the quid pro quo framework, which is land for peace, that Israel will maintain the territories that it occupied in 1967 in exchange for permanent peace. Except since then, what the United States has done is basically facilitated Israel's expansion, its settler colonial expansion in Jerusalem, in Gaza, in the West Bank, and throughout within Israel as well, where Palestinians are still being removed, right? And at the other side of its mouth, it says, but we believe in a two-state solution and we want peace. And then we see the first Bush administration actually broker that peace. When does Israel come to the table to even those peace negotiations? When the Bush administration said, we're not giving you funding. Because Israel cannot maintain this domination without an imperial broker, without financial, military, and diplomatic support. So no, it has not been an honest broker. The Oslo framework, and I can give you a whole lecture, I won't, is a trap that never ever mentions that there will be a Palestinian state, only promises Palestinian autonomy. For folks who don't know, that would look like native reservations in North America. So if you think that native people in North America have a state and are sovereign, right, you can't. It doesn't exist. They're autonomous, which means that they have derivative sovereignty and are dependent on the United States. We live in a settler colony. And so Israel has planned for Palestinians is what they're manifesting is to now concentrate Palestinians into areas A and B in the West Bank, to concentrate them also within Israel. They're mostly concentrated in the north and the Galilee, but we also see the largest concentration in the Gaza Strip. These are our current Bantustans and reservations. We have told people we are not in a conflict. We are in a struggle against our elimination. We would like to end this apartheid regime, and we need solidarity in order to do that.
You go ahead,
Sam. Oh, I just wanted to turn a little bit to the thesis of your book, Justice for Some. You argue as a human rights lawyer that this struggle, human rights legal action, more or less must be deployed more or less in service of a larger political program of liberation. I hope that's a fair assessment.
Can you restate that? Let me get it again.
That human rights legal action must follow a programmatic yes. strategy for yes. liberation. And so give us a sense of A, what that means in theory, and then in practice, like what that program needs to be. And then I guess for the sake of our audience and you know, what we can do in the context of the United States government to contribute to that program.
Sure. So most people, when they think of international law, it has a normative connotation of being somehow noble, that if international law prevails, then you're closer to utopia, right? But that's in my analysis and my critical theoretical approach to it, I'm basically challenging that assumption because I fit in a school of thought that believes that the law itself is indeterminate and is subject, its meaning and application is subject to the political context, a balance of military, economic, and political power that really determines what the law means and looks like. So I use the analogy of the sail of a boat, that if you are in a boat without, you know, oars or a rudder, you can't move. You need a sail. That sail is the law. But in order to determine, in order for the boat to move, you need wind, right? And the direction that the wind blows in is the political movement. Right. So the law is the sail of the boat. The wind is the political movement. It will determine which way the law works. Right. So my thesis is basically saying that law is politics, and to be leveraged for the service of an emancipatory purpose, it has to be used in a sophisticated service of political movement. Why? Because in about 100 years between 1917 and 2017, international law has actually done more to fulfill Israel's expansionist ambitions than it has to defend Palestinians. It is because of occupation law, not despite occupation law, that Israel has been able to increase its settler population in the West Bank from 200,000 in 1993 to 600,000 today, right? Under these, the false mythologies of temporariness and military necessity. So let me give you an example of one of the legal arguments that one of its legal architects has used, which is to say the occupation is not permanent, but it is indefinite. And indefinite means it doesn't necessarily end, but it can end, whereas permanent means it's there forever. So because this is indefinite, it's not permanent. Therefore, none of these settlements are illegal. I mean, that's the argument that they're using. And then they say that Palestinians are not a juridical people anyway, so that they don't apply occupation law as a matter of fact. And under these frameworks have been able to expand a settlement enterprise that today are regarded by the United States as facts on the ground, that it's don't look at international law. That's an impediment to resolving this. We have to just look at the facts on the ground and be pragmatic. Well, the facts on the ground is colonial violence is precisely the problem. You're forcing us not to deal with the root cause of Palestinian grievances. So then what do we do? I say, one, I think we need political movement. We need a robust political movement. The law is secondary. The law is not going to save Palestinians because it can easily be used against us. Even the ICC bid right now, the International Criminal Court, the first thing, if this goes through, the first thing the ICC will do is prosecute Palestinians. They're the lowest hanging fruit. So in order for on that example, I've been urging actually Palestinian legal advocates to wage a legal strategy, much like movement lawyers have waged. You know, we know we have legacy of movement lawyering in the US. Think of the civil rights movement, one of the most significant. Wage a movement legal campaign where even if we lose in the courtroom, we are able to leverage this opportunity in order to win everywhere else and to mobilize politically.
So I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, how are we going to reframe that conversation towards anti-Brown violence, towards colonialism, towards imperialism? Because as you mentioned earlier, I mean, the dominant narrative, at least in the United States, well, one, it's just protected by often, you know, right-wing evangelicals who are the real driver sometimes in this debate in the U.S. But it's just like, oh, this conflict is between Israel and Palestine, two actors, who knows who's correct here? When in fact, this is, you know, a systemic racism argument. So Is that a more effective way to go about it? Because that's not how it's talked about here.
Well, I think that's exactly what Palestinians have been trying to do, right? The fact that they want to emphasize there is a power disparity. This isn't about an age-old religious conflict. This isn't religious. Palestinians regard Jews as people of the book. There have been Palestinian Jews, and many Jews still identify as, this isn't religious. This is about colonization. This is about the transformation of Jewish religion into a juridical category that can be regulated by a state, where literally the state of Israel has bifurcated Israeli citizenship as distinct from Jewish nationality, and benefits flow to Jewish Zionists through the category of Jewish nationality that gives them the right to immigrate at any time from anywhere in the world and claim citizenship and a right to belong, the right to employment, the right to college education, the right to rule, the right to govern, the right to be masters, right? And so that's how those powers flow. And so Israel can say, oh, but we're a state of our citizens, which, by the way, they now say they no longer are since 2018. They say that they're a Jewish state only. But what's really happening is this flow of rights and privileges through a particular category. In any other context, no one would hesitate to call that out as racial discrimination. But the fact that it's because what seems to be happening is the collapse of Jewish religion with Jewish nationality, it makes people incredibly scared. Like, how can you speak and not be accused of anti-Semitism when the state itself has collapsed these categories? And one of the reasons that now we're seeing this pitched battle to even make it more so that anti-Zionism is equated to anti-Semitism, in my opinion, in the United States in particular, is because what ends up happening when we focus on Israel as the answer for Jewish liberation, which is a question which must be answered, which is part of our framework of integrated and intersectional struggle, right? But what happens when you equate it to the state of Israel is that you obscure the conversation we should be having about white supremacy and how white supremacy has excluded Jews from the framework of whiteness historically, and has even denied them emancipation throughout Europe that culminated in a mass annihilation campaign. We're not having that conversation. Instead, it becomes deflected onto some age-old primordial Muslim barbaric aversion to Jews, which for most people is much easier for them to stomach. I'm not that surprised. We can't even talk about anti-Black racism in the United States. So the fact that they can't recognize, you know, people get offended. I'm a parent. Parents write into schools. I don't want anyone to talk about racism in the classroom. So I'm not surprised that people don't want to talk about white supremacy as a central organizing principle of government, and that Zionism flows from that and enables the U.S., to avoid the conversation while it protects Israel and expands its own, I would describe them as imperial interests in the Middle East.
I just want to get back just one more time to that programmatic thing. I mean, the idea of movement lawyers and cases that are waged less for their legal implications and more for their political implications. Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Studies.
Yes.
There was his memoir.
You Rest in Peace and Power. Yes.
I mean, that was very much his strategy, I think, at the Center for Constitutional Rights. But what does that political program look like? Like, what is it exactly, you know, in a concrete way, as much as one can at this point, what does that look like? Is it to expose the white supremacy and the imperialism that is, and the colonialism that is part of it? I mean, what is that?
First of all, I'm a former Ella Baker at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm a mentee of Michael Ratner. We are all beneficiaries of his brilliance and his dedication and times when he has multiple times stood for what, you know, Slava Žižek would describe as lost causes, right? And so thank you for lifting his name up. What is that political program right now for Palestinians? That's really the question. And Palestinians are trying to answer that themselves, right? Because there isn't a united political program. There, the PLO, once it enters into, in 1968, the political program was a single democratic state for all people, right? Liberation of all of Palestine, single democratic state. It's a multi-ethnic democracy. Everyone can stay, right? By 1988, the Palestinians amend their constitution and change the political program so that they say, okay, we're going to recognize Israeli sovereignty over 78% of historic Palestine. We will establish a state in the West Bank and Gaza, but we will not forego our right of return either. Right. And that's where we've been stuck. Right. The Oslo Accords and the terms of Oslo. And when I write the book, I originally thought I'm going to translate Oslo from legalese and make it accessible to people who don't, you know, understand, aren't studied in law. But when I read through all the documents, I thought to myself, my God, you don't need to be a lawyer. You just need to be literate. This is a trap. This is a trap. There is no Palestinian state to emerge from this. Palestinians get jurisdiction over groups of people, but jurisdiction over no territory. What is jurisdiction over people without territory? That's a reservation, right? That was all that was promised. And so Israel's fulfilled its obligations, and that's what it tells us. And so now the political program, we're what, 1993 to 2021, 28 years? Is my math off?
It's good enough for this show.
Yeah, then we're in the same boat on that. We have damning empirical evidence that's demonstrated that this is a trap. Nonetheless, there is the Palestinian official leadership is still committed to this losing bet because it's the only card they have left. It's a stale leadership. They have sacrificed their entire life to get to this moment. Oslo was the only way they ever got to see their homeland again. So for them, they realize this, if they just keep trying, right? On faith that somehow this is going to work out. And now you have a complete, I'm part of this different generation, right? That says, look, thank you for your sacrifice. You got us incredibly far. That's it. At this point, you're digging our grave. We need to shift course. And we've been describing it as an apartheid regime. We've been highlighting this as a Zionist settler colony. We have been calling for a one-state solution. We've been calling for just a different outcome. In my own work, I'm not concerned with the state solution, right? I'm concerned with understanding what does it look like for us to all belong, right? Where we're no longer concerned with who's master, but we are more concerned with who can belong. Palestine should be a place of refuge for everyone, primarily Palestinian refugees, but any other refugees that need to be there. Right. I'm employing a different kind of imagination to ask Palestinians, to ask us, listen, rather than think about the return of refugees as the culmination of our freedom struggle, let's think of it as the beginning. Now that all Palestinians have returned, how do we make this a home for everyone? How do we offer Jews that stay, that can stay, that should stay? How do we offer them a better future than Israel has been able to offer them? The reason that we haven't been able to articulate and expand on these political programs, however, is because of the split, right, with the official leadership that remains intransigent and this, you know, movement that's very robust, as well as the fact that we're living in dire conditions where it's about survival. And so there hasn't been, you know, the ability, the support, the encouragement to be able to dream anew. We're stuck in a defensive posture with boots on our neck.
Noor Erekat, we will put a link to Jadalia and Justice for Some at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Emma and Sam. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll wrap this up. We'll be right back. We are back. Wrapping things up here. I don't know that from this distance we can see a change in these in the movement, and certainly there's a broader, I think, understanding that the two-state solution has time has passed it by. And so I just it is so discouraging to watch this slow, degradation.
Ethnic cleansing
that is, has been bit by bit happening, at an aggressive rate. I mean, it's been happening since 1948, but it has been happening, over the past 25, 30 years. There has been a real sort of expansion into that West Bank that was both predictable and lamentable. But that's it for us today. If you're watching on Peacock, we will say goodbye to you and we will be back tomorrow. However, if you are not watching us on the Peacock app, as frankly, most of you are not, we're still here. And in the fun half, not only is Naomi Kantz going to be joining us, but we also have a special guest. Aaron Chaudhary is going to be here. He's got a new show. But we will introduce them both in just a moment. Just a reminder, this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free half of the show, and you get it commercial-free. And then you also get the fun half, which is not always necessarily fun, but we're trying to. We're going to make it fun. Some days it's just a little bit not as fun. But also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Majority Discord. That's our new Discord. Join the conversation, folks.
Poggers.
Yep. Yeah. Well, that's
Twitch.
Oh my God, Emma, you just don't get it.
I'm not a part of the cool.
You just don't get it. You just cool don't kids. Get what's going on with Twitch. You just don't get it. Anyways, that's all right. We'll sit you down and we'll get you
need a tutorial.
Get you the glossary. Yeah, right. We'll show you how to work it.
Oh yeah, a glossary.
Yeah, a glossary.
Right, the Twitch glossary. I know more than you now.
We
flipped it.
So check that out. Also, we have an app, Majority App. You can find that. That is free, majorityapp.com, both iOS and Android. Matt Leck, what's happening in the Leckian media universe?
Check out last week's Left Reckoning, where we talk about pharma and Bill Gates and the vaccines. Also, Left Reckoning patrons will have gotten a special think tank last night where we talk about a very funny Jordan Peterson TikTok compilation where he's discussing Ratatouille, which I wanted to monetize by putting it behind a paywall. And also talked about Joe Biden reimposing work requirements and also Blinken's jousting with China. So that's for patrons. You can get that by going to patreon.com/leftreckoning right now.
Wait, Jordan Peterson was talking about Ratatouille?
Yeah, it was quite a while ago. Is this compilation, maybe we can play it in the fun half. It's very, very funny. He keeps talking about how rats sort of are dispositionally, and it's people, I guess, take that as deep archetypal sort of philosophy. So,
Janine was the voice.
Of Ratatouille?
In Ratatouille, yeah. She was one of the voices.
But not of
Patton Oswald was the Ratatouille.
Right. That's cool.
All right. Do we have? Wait, what?
Admitting them now.
We have a new horse trainer. Did that guy come back with the cancel of the horse?
Oh my! No, he's saying that he actually did drug the horse.
He admitted it.
Oh wow!
What was yesterday about? He was just lying.
Well, yesterday it was canceled, but today the truth comes out.
Wow, that's a lot of static, Naomi.
Yeah, Naomi Key, what is going on? You got catching a lot of air in that. There you go. All right, that sounds better.
I am.
Now it sounds.
I just turned my phone off. That's literally all I did.
I think it's just
the
Zoom,
power of a phone.
Oh yeah, you can't keep that next to it. So Nomi, what is happening on your show today? And then we can make your announcement.
Special guest.
Exactly.
Special situation. Today we are talking about Colombia with Andres Bernal, and we're going to have Joshua Khan Russell on and Caleb Lacey to talk about pretty much everything that's happening in Israel and Palestine right now. That's the jam. That's the story, all international, which is a great, smooth transition for special guest.
All right. Well, please introduce him.
Oh, hi. Okay. I'm introducing him? Okay. So welcome to the Majority Report. Is there a noise that we can make?
Sure. No? I can do this.
Sure.
Charge.
I feel like that was something. I feel jazzed.
That's so cliche, okay? Arun Chowdhury, straight from Berlin. Arun is not only a regular on our show every Thursday, he is now the host of the Committee Program, which airs Mondays over on our channel, The Nomi Key Show. It is a 3-hour jam-packed, beautiful, I mean, it's like an art form. It's a movie.
Oh, every, that
if
that
you
might
haven't
be
seen it, like, I
it's
feel
a craft
like crap. It's a craft form. Arun, who's Arun?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Welcome to the show. All right, well, you're going to join us in the fun half, and we will talk more about your show, and Brendan says you have got a nice mic setup, so congratulations.
He's a filmmaker, guys. He knows what he's doing.
Well, you got the the shock.
He's got the spit guard.
Oh.
I'll tell you what I've got. It's a Sennheiser 416, which is a shotgun microphone, a little unconventional to use for a voiceover, but I'll tell you who does or who did before he passed away is, oh God, and now I've forgotten his name, the Inner World guy, Don Fontaine.
Oh, yeah?
The Inner World guy.
I didn't realize that. That's the guy who did all the movie trailers. All right, folks, your mic just cut out. We will be back in just a moment. We will see you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.